Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Jason Leopold, who spent 2 years covering the California Enron electric power crisis as the Los Angeles bureau chief of the Dow Jones Newswire. He has been a regular contributor to Truthout, and he's worked for the last few years cultivating sources close to the Fitzgerald Plame Wilson CIA leak investigation, and he's broken a number of ongoing stories from his investigative work, and he'll be joining us in a moment to discuss the what he believes to be the forthcoming indictment of Karl Rove, and we'll also speak with Jonathan Weiner, who's a former Assistant Secretary of State for International Law Enforcement. And he is a veteran consumer of intelligence, and we'll be talking to him about the shuffling, reshuffling of the decks in terms of the structure of intelligence and the extent to which the CIA has already been damaged by Portegas and is about to be taken over by General Hayden, who has obviously more than his handful of troubles, having authorized, when he was at the National Security Agency, the spying on American citizens that has broken this week in USA Today, and promises to be a major political milestone around the neck of the president, who tomorrow, Monday, will be going down to the border to perhaps distract us all from his troubles by grandstanding to his right-wing base, by putting troops on the border. Perhaps he's also maybe trying to cover or distract the forthcoming news involving his right-hand man, Karl Rove. So we look into some of that conjecture, and then we'll talk about specifically about the implications of the USA Today story, saying that tens of millions of Americans have in fact been spied on. At least their phone records have been secretly gathered by the National Security Agency. We'll be talking to Nancy Libben, who's a staff counsel at the Center for Democracy and Technology, where she her work focuses on national security, government surveillance, and the Fourth Amendment issues. And we'll be talking, obviously, about the recent revelations about the NSA's domestic spying. And we'll also speak with Kevin Bankston, who's a staff attorney specializing in free speech and privacy law. He's with the Electronic Frontier Foundation's Equal Justice Works, and it is, of course, the Electronic Frontier Foundation were the group that first sued American phone companies, who in fact turned out to be working with the government. So we'll be looking into the status of the Electronic Frontier Foundation's lawsuit against the telephone companies for violating the laws to protect the privacy of their customers' citizen phone calls. I'm now speaking with Jason Leopold, who, as I mentioned, spent 2 years covering California's Enron electric power crisis as the Los Angeles bureau chief for Dow Jones Newswire. He's been regularly contributing to Truthout, as well as the Wall Street Journal, Huffington Post, and Financial Times. And we spoke, what was it, about 3 weeks ago on this program, Jason? Yeah, and you mentioned at that time that you expected Karl Rove to be indicted before Memorial Day.
Correct.
I take it you're moving up the timetable here.
Ian, I'm going to give you some insight into the story. I also just want to mention, this is not just a mere plug, but I have a book out that's called News Junkie.
Right.
It just came out a couple of weeks ago, and not only do I reveal the secrets of my own past, but I really give a behind-the-scenes look at the world of investigative journalism, the world of mainstream journalism, and the problems that exist in mainstream journalism. On the Karl Rove story, let me just say that for more than a year, I have been on this story, and I have received, over the past couple of weeks, some information from sources that I have cultivated that I could tell you that no other media outlet in Washington has. Now, on Friday, I had put out a story about Karl Rove informing the White House already that he will be indicted. This was a story that was backed up, obviously, by anonymous sources, but these are sources who, first of all, it's more than two, and they are definitely in the know. On Saturday, I received a level of detail of information on what took place Friday, this past Friday, that was quite explosive. Now, these are people that I trust. They are also sources who know full well that if they led me astray, they would no longer be anonymous sources. And the level of detail that I received was fascinating. On Saturday morning, I was told that the action on Friday was not at the grand jury, but was actually at Patton Boggs, the law firm representing Karl Rove. And I was provided with serious detail. And that detail is that at 11:30 in the morning, Patrick Fitzgerald, the special prosecutor, had gone to Patton Boggs to meet with Rove's attorneys. And he spent many, many hours there. Karl Rove, in addition, was there with his Secret Service detail. And from what I understand, they may have been spending time hammering out some sort of plea agreement. But ultimately, this plea agreement was rejected. In addition, at the end of their lengthy meetings, Patrick Fitzgerald handed indictment to Rove's attorney and instructed Rove that he has 24 business hours to get his affairs in order. I confirmed this story with my sources, and of course I ran with this. Now, obviously, nobody else has picked it up yet. And that goes beyond the actual issue that we're looking at right now. As far as I'm concerned, for me, this is the one of the biggest stories that I have certainly ever reported. It is also the biggest story that Truth Out, an independent media outlet, has reported. But the questions that exist as to why the mainstream media, why the Washington Post or the New York Times or Newsweek has not reported this, well, I can't answer that. And if they do not have the same sources that I have, well, that could be a reason. In addition, we have been, you know, as consumers of news, we have consistently seen the newspapers, magazines, and cable outlets that we've trusted fail miserably at their jobs. And the New York Times is a perfect example of sitting on the NSA story for a year without providing a good explanation. So now I have to sit here and wait till the actual news happens before I can say, hey, this was right the whole time. I would hope that there are reporters out there that are following this up, because the level of detail that I received from this meeting at Patton Boggs, it's too real.
But we're talking about a pretty fast-moving time frame here, Jason Leopold. If Rove has been given 24 hours, business hours, to get his affairs together.
When this story that I reported, and excuse me for sounding defensive, but you could imagine, Ian, going out with a story like this. I mean, I'm an incredibly aggressive reporter, and I can just say that this was not something that we put out there without thinking, without fact-checking, and without making sure that it was correct. And again, I will reiterate, the sources that I have had on this story know full well that leading me astray or my news organization astray, I would no longer be obliged to keep their identities secret. I would imagine that there may be some others looking at this in the mainstream. And I know that a report from the Washington Post or CNN or the New York Times would lend credibility. And believe me, I'm hoping that actually happens. But I've been covering this consistently, and I think that the mainstream media has failed miserably in their coverage of this story.
Right.
And that is exactly the reason that I publish for Truth Out.
Obviously, time will tell, and we're talking about a pretty fast-moving time frame here. Now, Jason Leopold, in your Friday story, you first mentioned that Rove had told both President Bush and the new Chief of Staff, Joshua Bolten, that right. he was either about to be indicted or would be indicted.
Right.
And you mentioned in that story that there are a number of White House staffers who had verified this.
Correct.
So what puzzles me is that how come the mainstream press doesn't have access to these staffers?
I can't account for why Michael Isikoff, Jim Vandehei of the Washington Post, or anyone at the New York Times doesn't report this. When I called the White House, what is surprising to me is the fact that the White House, there are people in the White House who want to move their policy issues forward. While great loyalty to Karl Rove, there's also a cloud of uncertainty hanging over the White House as long as his case remains in limbo. In their eyes, they feel that if this could move forward, if he's indicted, let it be indicted so we can move on. That's what they're looking at. And I simply did this. It was not a matter of these people at the White House calling me. When the issue with Karl Rove has escalated in the past month, I thought of, what is Karl Rove telling the White House? And the reason I say that is because about 3 or 4 weeks ago, prior to the reorganization going on in the White House, in which Rove was actually stripped of his policy duties, there was a meeting between Patrick Fitzgerald and Robert Luskin regarding Karl Rove's fifth grand jury appearance that was coming up. And it was when Karl Rove told Joshua Bolton that his role in the case was going to become public again that the announcement was made to reorganize the internal workings of the White House. So there's a connection there. Now, that's an element that wasn't reported as well. And I went with that story wondering, what else did Karl Rove tell the White House?
But specifically, Jason, what you're reporting here today and yesterday and on Friday is that the Friday, there was a long meeting at the law offices of the lawyers representing Karl Rove, Robert Luskin, at which Karl Rove was present and so was the special prosecutor. And after a plea agreement was attempted to be hammered out, at the end of this, Fitzgerald handed Karl Rove an indictment.
Handed his attorney papers regarding the indictment, correct.
And that giving him 24 business hours to get his affairs in order. Now, does that mean that indictment is sealed and will be unsealed within 24 business hours?
That's a legal area that I've tried to figure out. From what I understand, yes. It's sealed before it becomes public. From what I understand, it would be 24 hours. And I would imagine that, I'm saying this without a doubt, just what my headline and my story says, Karl Rove indicted. I was very specific with the details of this story. I challenge people to go out there and go beyond the Karl Rove's attorney or Karl Rove's spokesperson to flesh this story out, do some gumshoe reporting here. In terms of whether it's sealed, that's what I understand. The way I understand the way the legal process works is it's sealed, and then once the announcement is made in which they list or go through the charges, that is what's considered unsealed.
So, Jason, when do you get vindicated, and when do we, the public, get the official news that Rove has been indicted?
I from what I understand at this point, it could be either Wednesday or Friday. And I believe it will be much earlier in the week. Patrick Fitzgerald has gone back and forth from Chicago to Washington on numerous occasions. And so any time after Monday of this week, I strongly believe that we will hear something this week. I mean, this has been almost 3 weeks since Karl Rove made his fifth grand jury appearance. Absolutely an end to the case. And
That's unprecedented in itself, I think. I mean, not unprecedented, but it's highly unusual to have five.
Incredibly unusual.
Five. And was the last one, was that at his behest, or did they call him in, or did he go in voluntarily again?
That was what his attorney had. This was not at his, they did not call him in.
Right.
Karl Rove and his attorney, if anything, that's something that you want your client to avoid simple fact of he could possibly wind up with even more charges, or his story doesn't fit the other grand jury testimonies. Hmm. So this was something that his attorney had, had requested simply, in hopes that maybe they can fend off what ultimately will be this indictment. And I understand the excitement out there. I understand that people are waiting for this. I also understand that this is one of the biggest stories to come out of Washington. I mean, we're talking about Karl Rove, the most powerful political operative. This is not a type of story that I or my news organization, Truth Out, would go with if we were not confident that the details that we have received are bulletproof.
And, of course, what Fitzgerald did reveal this week in court papers that were filed was that Vice President Cheney apparently they have a document which is actually a copy of the op-ed that Joseph Wilson wrote in the New York Times on July the 6th of 03, which the vice president wrote on, basically saying, this guy, who is he, some freelancer who went pro bono over there, and did his wife send him,
Or did his wife send him on a quote-unquote junket?
Right.
This demonstrates that Fitzgerald fits the descriptions of his colleagues, the way he works cases, as going after the big fish. Now, I think that these were notes that Vice President Cheney had written on the article that were then passed along to Scooter Libby. Now, this is the second time that we have seen that, the prosecutor has shown how large of a role that the vice president had in this, and in addition, how focused on Joe Wilson they were. And the fact that, in addition to that, even moreover, that they knew who his wife was. Did his wife send him on a junket? Well, that, you know, that demonstrates that they knew who his wife is. This is very serious. This is incredibly serious. It's interesting because this document, and it was filed late Friday night, just before midnight, electronically in a courthouse in Washington, D.C. And, you know, I looked at it on Saturday morning, and it's explosive. We haven't even seen the end of the scandals. And I simply treat this, Ian, as, you know, a big story. And my goal here is to get to the truth, to report the truth, to show what was going on. It needs to be reported.
You have a scoop, and if in the next couple of days Rove is indicted. I thank you so much for joining us, Jason Leopold.
Thank you, Ian. Anytime. I'm happy to speak with you.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Hello again. I'm Ian Master. Just speaking then with Jason Leopold, who covered the Enron California power crisis for the Dow Jones Newswires. You've been filing stories on Truthout on the ongoing Fitzgerald Plame CIA leak investigation. I'm now speaking with Jonathan Weiner, who's a former Assistant Secretary of State for International Law Enforcement. He's a veteran consumer of intelligence, and he also serves as a member of the Council on Foreign Relations Task Force on Terrorist Financing and the Steering Committee of the Transnational Threats Initiative of the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And clearly, transnational threats are the 21st century national security threats, and it does appear that ever since 9/11, we've been behind the curve in the sense that much of our focus seem, or at least our habits seem to be Cold War habits, at the extent to which the ill-fated invasion of Iraq is seen by many as one of the most serious strategic blunders. We're told that one of the reasons we went into Iraq was that after Afghanistan, Donald Rumsfeld said there are no decent targets. You know, in other words, Saddam Hussein had an address. So, is our intelligence system broken at the top or at the bottom, Jonathan?
Well, first of all, intelligence is a hard business. You have a number of very hardworking people who work at the CIA, at the DIA, at the NSA, and at the rest of the alphabet soup of intelligence agencies, who are academics or technocrats or analysts or whatever you want to call them, but they're straight non-political people, and they're trying to find the answers to the questions that the policymakers ask of them. Now, the problem is that the policymakers are asking the wrong questions or are not interested in the true answers. And if they punish people who give them answers they don't like, you begin to have injury to a system that can only work reasonably well under the best of circumstances. I mean, intelligence is a very hard business because gathering the data points and to figure out what the nature of reality is difficult. Now, in the Clinton administration, which I served in for 6 years, from time to time, analysts would feel that their views were unwelcome. I mean, for example, on Russia, there were some analysts who I knew who quit in disgust when their perception that serious Russian criminal organizations had penetrated and interpenetrated the government. And it was not a popular assessment in the early years of the Clinton administration when there was a lot of pressure to try and help Russia get rid of government because they never wanted to see the communists back. And the notion that the government was corrupt and close to organized crime was initially very unpopular. So the politicization problem, or the problem that analysts have in getting policymakers to understand reality, is not limited to this administration. It's probably gotten quite a bit worse in this administration. And you know, morale in the agency, the people I know people who are leaving, and they're leaving because it has been politicized under Porter Goss, and they're very upset that it's been politicized.
But it seems that since 9/11 and the WMD intelligence meltdown, there has been this feeling that this accident is being blamed on the car, not the driver. And
that's right, and that's not fair. It should have been blamed on the driver. It was not the car. There were people in the agency who were trying to get it right. But if you push people very hard one direction, and you lean and you lean and you lean, the car is going to go where the driver wants it to go. And that's unfortunate. It's the nature of human beings. Only so many people are going to stand up when they're being bullied.
That leads
their career is at stake.
But this leads you to ask rhetorically, concerned about America being the lone superpower and its diminishing effectiveness and standing in the world. How does this country reestablish some strategic vision? That's what's clearly been lacking. We don't have any strategic vision.
Yeah, we did actually in the latter part of the Clinton administration. What's interesting is that President Clinton, as he learned about the world as president, after the first couple of years, where I thought he was not a strong national security president, even though it was the administration that I was serving in, began to recognize pretty early that transnational threats, whether you're talking about environmental change or criminal organizations or terrorists or drug traffickers, all of whom he focused on, or money moving across borders illicitly, or intellectual property moving, either that's dangerous or that isn't paid for, that whatever our problem was, immigrants moving across borders, with criminal organizations pushing around, whatever it is that's moving across borders, you're going to need transnational government capabilities that are standardized and harmonized and competent to deal with it. So our direction for about 1994 on was to try and build capacities in other governments so we could exchange information with one another, so we could work together on common problems with common solutions, and then work on outliers afterwards. If you get a consensus about how to attack a problem, and then there are some countries that refuse to participate, then you can go beat them up or focus your attention on otherwise dealing with them, or seal yourself off from them. It was a strategy, and it was a vision. It was slow. It was bit by bit, piece by piece. We absolutely had a lot of progress over a period of a number of years doing it. The Bush administration has chosen to act much more unilaterally, and the world is not a unilateralist place. I mean, if the fact is we control, 6-7% of the Earth's land space, and what percent of the population? It's 5% of the world's population, or 6%. We don't get the cooperation and participation of the rest of the world, we are not going to be able to protect our people.
Well, that was the most
glaring. That's a core place you have to begin with.
Well, that was the most glaring. It seems as if shortly after 9/11, we got off on the wrong foot when the president finally kind of came down to ground. He announced this war on terrorism, which obviously had certain domestic political advantages for him. But it seemed to me that that when the world was sympathetic to the United States as the victim, and the leading French newspapers were saying we're all Americans, that seemed to be the time when you should have gotten the world together, right there in New York, where the horrible incident had taken place, and forged an international compact, because as you rightly point out, Jonathan Weiner, the problem is over there, not here. These mythical sleeper cells aren't turning up, but we know that all of the 9/11 people were mostly in Europe.
The European problem right now with Islamic extremism is huge, because they have very substantial Muslim populations. Within those populations, there are small groups of people who are sufficiently disaffected and angry to carry out terrorist attacks, as we've seen in Madrid and London. Now, we had that domestically in the United States with the militia movement in the early 1990s. And prior to Timothy McVeigh blowing up Oklahoma and killing those children when they were in the daycare center, I heard senior people in the FBI and DEA say to me the thing they were most worried about was the U.S. militias. And that's because the rhetoric of the day was anti-government. And after it happened, while the militias still existed, they became much less of a threat, because the militias themselves recognized this was not something that they wanted. And what happened after September 11th is even angry people in the Islamic world said, this is not what we wanted. And I think the threat diminished substantially, even as we went into Afghanistan and cleaned out the Taliban, which was essential. The problem we face now is that in the Iraq situation, we're in a situation where every single day there continue to be people murdered.
1,100 in the last month in Baghdad alone.
Yeah, and Islamic support for our government, as you can see, Pew poll and so on, a variety of different polls, is deteriorated enormously. So we haven't been winning hearts and minds; we've been losing them, and that's very dangerous for us. And
well,
unilateralism is not going to protect us. We need to get the world to be able to support where we're going. That's the only solution.
But it seems to me, and I said it in the setup to this interview, Jonathan, that one of the things that Rumsfeld said was there aren't any good targets in Afghanistan, but they are in Iraq. I mean, was it that much of Cold War thinking that we went after Saddam because he had an address?
What went into their thinking? I wasn't inside.
Well, I'm saying that in the Cold War thinking, at least Saddam has an address, whereas Bin Laden doesn't. You know?
Yeah, I think it was a gross strategic error going into Iraq. It was based on distortions of intelligence, and it was based on faith rather than facts. And I've seen again and again U.S. foreign policy go off when people don't respect sufficiently facts in the field. When you base your policies on what you want and what you wish and what you believe in Washington, as opposed to reality in the field, you can get yourself in pretty serious trouble pretty quickly. Reality in the field is we've got some very angry people located in small cells of probably 8 people typically, located in a bunch of different places, who are planning to do harm. And if you don't have the people around them sort of ready to say, wait a minute, this is bad, this is a terrible thing, if you don't have essentially goodwill in the sea in which they swim, you're going to be at risk. And figuring out now how you build popular intolerance for acts of violence is really critical. You would think the world would be with us in wanting stability and security and peace and quiet, but it's not clear that's entirely the case.
Well, let's just, Jonathan Weiner, look at what's happening in the name of intelligence reform. In the broader picture, we mentioned earlier that instead of blaming the driver, they blamed the car, the extent to which there's been this reshuffling, and the intelligence committees themselves were a part of putting in this layer known as the Director of National Intelligence. Now, clearly, Porter Goss being sent to the CIA has been disastrous for the CIA. The so-called Gosslings apparently drove out a lot of the
Gosslings were political, and politicizing intelligence is just about the worst thing you can do. It's worse than ignoring it.
Right, and they drove a lot of people out, and then more recently they just fired an analyst
Barry McCarthy.
Who apparently was working in the Inspector General's office and may well have been onto this stuff that's now breaking, where they just this week raided Dusty Fogo's farm and his office at the agency. Turns out he was regular at his poker games was Pat Murray, who's the aide to Goss. So perhaps there was some preemptive withdrawal there of Goss before this scandal broke, and clearly it's going to become a bigger scandal. But that seems to be sort of small stuff compared to with the structural stuff. What's your feelings about General Hayden? Obviously, he's got a handful of problems on his own.
I don't think it's small stuff, actually. I think that if you have political people who were associated with Republican politicians, which Porter Goss was for many years before he became director of the DCI, director of Central Intelligence, if you have that kind of person involved in steering contracts on important areas of national security and engaged in activity that is criminal or quasi-criminal, the allegations of prostitution, hiring prostitutes and so on, and having a convicted criminal involved in providing some of the services. It's the kind of thing that really needs to be fully investigated and understood to determine what else went on. Mm-hmm. What's particularly disturbing to me is that the person who was fired, Mary McCarthy, was in the Inspector General's office, which raises a question as to whether there was retaliation against her because she was looking at them. That may not be true, but it's a fair question to ask as to whether it is true. And again, it needs to be investigated. We need to make sure that we have adequate oversight mechanisms so that the truth comes out, whatever it is. And in terms of the domestic surveillance, again, it's a matter in the first instance of making sure we know what happened, that there is adequate oversight. And the problem these last years is that Congress has not been engaging in oversight. It's been a rubber stamp, and that's not good for the country.
Well, indeed, there might well be more congressmen involved in these this so-called Hookergate scandal than Randy Duke Cunningham. There's already indications that a couple of congressmen out here are in the crosshairs.
Well, you know, the thing about prostitutes and that kind of an issue and the petty corruption when somebody takes gifts that they shouldn't take, you know, the prostitutes don't matter, the gifts don't matter. What matters is that you get involved in a web of criminal activity in which much more serious activity can be surrounding that, because once you've been compromised as a result of that kind of petty human misbehavior, the things that surround it can get to be very serious. You can have contractors getting millions of dollars who are not actually providing the services required. We've had a press account today of how a necessary ID, secure ID for transportation workers was slowed for the last 5 years because a congressman essentially steered and controlled the contracts not only to his district but to organizations associated with him. When you wind up damaging national security in that way as a result of personal corruption and cupidity, it's very, very frightening. And again, the only solution a democracy has is oversight, getting the truth out to where people can see it, and then allowing the voters to make appropriate decisions from there. If you don't have that kind of feedback loop, you wind up with the society destroying itself, which is one of the things that happened under Saddam Hussein in Iraq. Nobody knew what the truth was anymore.
Well, it's also the reason that the Soviets collapsed. They couldn't tell the difference between rhetoric and reality.
That's exactly right.
And if we're going to if we're heading down that path,
we can't. We can't afford it. We absolutely need to have integrity in government and public life, and the people need to know the truth. It's the foundation. It's where you start from.
But how what kind of a role have the Intelligence Oversight Committees played in this? Because you get the impression, for example, that Pat Roberts is pretty partisan. There's a phase two investigation into the use of pre-war intelligence on the Iraq war, where there's some indications that that he doesn't want to look into the origin of the Niger documents, for example, which were the basis of why Wilson was sent over there in the first place.
When I was in the Clinton administration, and I was a Democrat, I worked for John Kerry for many years, we knew that there would always be oversight of us, and hostile oversight, not just skeptical, but hostile from the Congress, which is controlled by the Republicans. And we made sure that we did everything right. And what was interesting was I would have Republicans, sometimes very conservative ones, actually join me on foreign delegations monitoring what I was doing, and I would welcome it because it would make sure that whatever I did would look good in the light of day. And we had that oversight. The Bush administration has not had that kind of oversight, and it's dangerous.
Well, just in closing then, Jonathan Weiner, the New York Times is suggesting today in a lead article, Langley, we have a problem, that the CIA once sought the big picture, now it's left with the pieces. Is it...
I think that's an exaggeration.
It is an exaggeration, but let me get a sense again. I'm concerned that we don't have a strategic vision. It's a strategic blindness that got us into this mess in Iraq, and perhaps that's because the American people have to start hiring better qualities of leaders. But just institutionally, what can be done, and what is what is being done counterproductive?
Well, we have not had good leadership lately at the senior levels of the intelligence community. I know somebody who's a career intelligence person. This person has spent 30 years in the CIA, is extraordinarily high quality. This person's in a senior position still at the CIA, is leaving at the end of the summer, beginning of the fall, and the person said to me, "My boss is dumber than a block of wood." My boss is dumber than a block of wood, and this person is already quite senior. I'm referring to somebody more senior than this person. I said, "You can't leave. You know what you're doing. You're highly competent. Please don't leave." The person said, "I can't take it anymore. I'm out of here." And that's not good for the country.
So structurally, then, what can you do about that? I mean, apart from hire better people.
Yeah, you need to have the system of career civil servants rewarded, made secure, given the right to dissent. The right to dissent is tremendously important, given the ability to have a career over a long time and to think and analyze honestly and get quality people in and have them supported by the system, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, and you need adequate oversight.
Well, but let's face it, Jonathan, what's happened with the way that the Bush administration have attacked and outed Valerie Plame, it would indicate that they're sending a signal to the intelligence community. It's not a good career move to speak truth to power.
The intimidation of intelligence analysts is a very dangerous phenomenon in any administration, and it happened some. In the Clinton administration early on, it wasn't good. It appears to have been much worse in the Bush administration. It's always a tension in a democracy, and it's got to stop. It's got to be pushed back, and we have to have integrity and oversight.
I thank you so much for joining us in Los Angeles, Jonathan Weiner.
Yes, sir. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Hello again. I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Jonathan Weiner. He's a former Assistant Secretary of State for International Law Enforcement. He's a specialist in transnational crime and transnational issues, and he's been a longtime consumer of intelligence, serves as a member of the Council on Foreign Relations Task Force on Terrorist Financing and the Steering Committee of Transnational Threats, the Transnational Threats Initiative at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. I'm now speaking with Nancy Libin, who is a staff counsel for the Center for Democracy and Technology, where her work focuses on national security, government surveillance, and Fourth Amendment issues. And I'm also speaking with Kevin Bankston, who's a staff attorney specializing in free speech and privacy law with the Electronic Frontier Foundation's Equal Justice Works. And the Electronic Frontier Foundation's lawsuit against the telephone companies for violating the law of protecting the privacy of their consumers and citizens' phone calls preceded this story that broke just this week in USA Today. Let me begin with you, Kevin. Why did the Electronic Frontier Foundation sue the phone companies? Did you have knowledge before this story broke in this week?
Well, I can't talk about what our pre-litigation investigation looked like. That's privileged. But I can say that the allegations that we made in our complaint were consistent and are consistent with what's been reported in the press, that being that AT&T has given the NSA direct access to all of its major internet and phone facilities, such that the NSA has the power to listen in on the calls of any and every American it chooses to, and also that AT&T has been disclosing call detail records about all of its customers, something that actually was reported way back in December by the LA Times.
And specifically, how's this done? I understand that in AT&T, Verizon, and Bell South's main offices, there's a separate room that the NSA has, and that whatever the billing computer is, it's splits into this room.
And unfortunately, I can't actually discuss the evidence that we've put in under seal. We filed a preliminary injunction motion to try and get the court to stop this illegal spying before we go to trial, based on evidence from an ex-AT&T technician, a Mr. Mark Klein, a 22-year veteran of AT&T, and I think a whistleblower and true American hero who came forward with evidence, which AT&T claims is confidential and contains their trade secrets. So we actually have a hearing in front of the judge next week to fight over whether or not the public should get to see the filings that we've made. We certainly think that the American public does have a right to see what evidence we have of the NSA's unchecked spying abilities.
But the government has joined in with AT&T under seal, apparently, trying to stop you.
Absolutely. The government, under cover of night at 1:22 a.m. in the morning on Saturday, which kind of crimps on the press cycle a bit, the government filed a motion to dismiss our case, saying that any discovery in our case to try and prove our allegations would reveal state secrets that are harmful to the national security. Frankly, I don't see how proving facts that have already been widely reported in the press would harm the national security. But even going farther, it seems that they are arguing that regardless of the illegality and the scope of the illegal surveillance of the NSA, regardless of whether our allegations are true, no one could ever challenge the NSA's surveillance of ordinary Americans so long as they claimed it was done in the name of national security. They're basically arguing that the NSA cannot and should not be checked by any court.
Let me turn to Nancy Libin, who's a staff counsel with the Center for Democracy and Technology. Nancy, what seems to be looming as a really scary portent in all of this is the Big Brother 1984 notion, but with a slight twist in this case. The possibility of a mendacious alliance between big government and big corporations at the expense of the people.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I think that we've seen is that the president has said that this monitoring has been limited to Al-Qaeda, but the latest revelations make clear that the government is scooping up the phone records and calling patterns of tens of millions of innocent American people. And we already know that the government can get access to and has acquired other kinds of information about U.S. citizens and could theoretically link all of this information in a big database and create very rich profiles of American people. And there are no, as Kevin had mentioned, there's no oversight over these NSA activities. And I think we need to bring our system of government back into balance. Have a full inquiry into this program and restore the checks and balances in our system.
Well, there is oversight over the NSA. It's called the FISA Court. The Bush administration has chosen to circumvent that oversight.
Well, that's right. And the first surveillance program we heard about that the New York Times broke last December is a program that circumvents the FISA Court, really leaves any kind of role for the judiciary out. And that is a decision that was made, apparently, the administration and at the NSA. That is specifically, their conduct is prohibited by FISA. They have said that their eavesdropping is limited to calls where one leg of the call is abroad. But FISA expressly prohibits eavesdropping without a warrant on an American citizen in the United States, regardless of whether that person's calling their next-door neighbor or calling somebody halfway around the world.
And it's worth noting that the administration, even though they were conducting this secret program, which we now know a lot more about, it's almost total information awareness, but they still use the FISA court as a cover. I mean, in other words, they didn't suddenly stop using the FISA court, which would indicate that they knew exactly what they were doing. But just to go back to that question, though, Nancy, is there reciprocity here? Because we know that the phone companies, that the NSA paid the phone companies. Perhaps they paid to install these rooms where they have they take the split. But on the other hand, what it raises the possibility of is some kind of quid pro quo, because we know that the telephone companies want to take over the internet and basically control the pipe. They've got in the House, they've got the friendly congressman down there in Texas, representing Bell South, or at least doing carrying their water. So, could it be that they agreed to help the government out in exchange for the government helping them out?
Well, that's an interesting question. I don't know enough about what the behind-the-scenes negotiations were, but I will say, I think you've hit on this, that it was highly unusual, and the reports in the USA Today article state that the government entered into a contract with Bell South, AT&T, and Verizon to essentially purchase the phone records of, as I said, tens of millions of Americans. That's not the way Congress has set up the system for the government to purchase this, to get this information. Excuse me, they're not supposed to purchase it. They're supposed to either come to the phone company with a court order, or with what's called a national security letter, where the government certifies that the records they seek are related to an ongoing terrorist investigation. They're not supposed to just go and purchase that information. And so it's clear that the procedures, at least based on these reports, were not followed. And that if that's the case, this was an illegal acquisition of information by the government.
And Kevin, do you have any sense that there's a portent of reciprocity here? In other words, we scratch your back, you scratch ours?
Well, I mean, I think it's sufficient to say that the telecommunications industry is definitely a highly regulated one, and also that at least AT&T relies on the government as one of its biggest, if not its biggest, client. And so certainly it is possible that that played into their decision.
And it's also true, is it not, that the telcos want to, through their political clout, with the oversight committees, want to basically start charging people for the pipe?
Oh, yes, certainly. There is another issue going on right now over net neutrality, over whether or not the telecoms can charge certain services a higher tier of payment for getting preferential treatment on their network. Whether or not that issue is related to this one, I really can't say.
Right. But it is a major issue in itself.
Absolutely.
They no longer want to be common carriers, but essentially toll booths on the information highway. Let me go ask you then, Kevin Bankston, who's the staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who some time back sued AT&T for cooperating with the government before the story, all of the story broke just this week. So if the government has stymied you or trying to under seal stop you, what's the next move?
Well, there's a lot of different motions up in the air right now. First off, next week, as I said, we're going to be fighting over the secrecy of some AT&T internal documents that were provided by a whistleblower. And then there is the government's motion to dismiss the case. AT&T has moved to dismiss the case. And we, as I mentioned, somewhat based on this sealed evidence, have moved for a preliminary injunction in the case. When those are going to be heard is unclear at the moment. AT&T and the government are asking that the judge hear all of those arguments on the same day, June 21st, in about a month and a half. We were expecting these motions to dismiss. We intend to oppose them vigorously, and that's where our case is right now. We're just chugging along, working on our legal arguments, sharpening our knives to argue in court.
But it sounds like there's been a Pandora's box opened here in terms of citizens' outrage at their own phone companies, and lawsuits are going to be flying thick and fast.
Yeah, the latest polls do show that most Americans think this this program discussed in the USA Today story overreaches, that it invades too much privacy, and that this administration has overreached in this program. But that leads me to another point, which I think discussing this in terms of this program and that program is falling into one of their language traps. It was their choice, by parsing their words very carefully in the past, they can say that they weren't lying to us when they said this only reached international calls, because what they kept doing was saying the terrorist surveillance program, which the president described, is limited to international calls linked to al-Qaeda, and we're not going to talk about any other possible programs. And so then this new program pops up, and they say, well, of course we didn't lie about that. We just said the program that you were already on to didn't include this one. I think, to my mind, I think the approach is these are all programs of illegal domestic surveillance, and when the administration is questioned on them, it should be truthfully answering about the entire scope of what's going on.
Well, let me ask Nancy then. Nancy Dibben, then, what do you think the political fallout is? Not just in terms of consumers being outraged at their betrayal of their records being made given to the government. Russell Tice, former NSA officer, will be going before the Senate Select Committee next week to reveal what's known about some of these programs, which he apparently believes we're only seeing the tip of the iceberg here.
Well, I think that's right, and I think that the more we see the next shoe dropping, as we saw this week, I think that the administration continues to lose credibility on this issue. What little credibility is left, and this whole notion of trust me. That's not the principle on which our democracy functions. We've got a system of checks and balances. It's time for Congress to step up, and hopefully they will feel it more emboldened now as the American people continue to express outrage to restore their rightful place and conduct oversight over these activities in the executive branch, and also the role of the judiciary to step up. The FISA court should be involved in all of this, and I'm hoping that this will be a turning point, and we will see a reinvigorated role for the intelligence committees and the judiciary committee, and that there will be a full inquiry into, as Kevin said, all of the NSA surveillance programs that have been going on.
Well, it used to be at the NSA, the 11th commandment was, thou shalt not spy on American citizens. That seems to have gone right out the window. When you poll the public, a lot of these polls, like the ABC poll, I don't think reflected what the people really believe, because if you tell them that without a warrant, that's the key thing, the key question to ask. So do you think that the American people are really vigilant about the Fourth Amendment? Do they understand what's at stake?
Well,
both of you, just quick last answer.
Right. Well, I think that this latest revelation, people finally, I think, hit home when people found out that their phone records are now reside at the NSA in a big database. I think it does start to make people feel very uncomfortable with this notion of unchecked power.
And Kevin, a quick last word from you, and in terms of Senator Feinstein says we need to have a debate on the Fourth Amendment. Where does it stand?
Well, definitely we do need to see a revitalized inquiry from Congress, and I'm very heartened by Senator Spector's plan to call the telecommunications companies to account and subpoena them if they don't show up voluntarily. Without effective oversight from Congress or the courts, what we're going to be faced with is a secret security agency with an unchecked ability to spy on any and every American it chooses.
And
as Senator Frank Church said in the 70s when he was investigating the NSA, he didn't ever want to see our country go over that bridge, because that's an abyss from which we cannot return. If those in power can unchecked spy on anyone they like, then democracy itself is threatened. This is not only about personal privacy. This is about our privacy and our liberty as a nation.
I thank you very much for joining us, Nancy Libben, Staff Counsel for the Center for Democracy and Technology, and Kevin Bankston, the Staff Attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. I thank Lewis Vandenberg, the producer, Jazz Shepherd, the engineer, Rusty Wynn, the associate producer, and Carol Coote, the assistant producer.